We are talking with Dan Rayner about Asa Tru, our beautiful traditions, culture, heritage, and love for our people, and also, of course, of the awakening process of this spiritual tradition, both in ourselves as it's part of us, but also in the larger picture, something that is desperately needed at these times to understand a little bit more about what's going on and how to kind of anchor ourselves a little bit more, because we have been rootless in the European men and women have been rootless for way too long, and this has caused a lot of issues and problems. And I ultimately believe that this is one of the reasons why things have gotten so unbalanced that they have. There's a lot more we are going to talk about when it comes to this. But before we go into some of these more aspects of Asa Tru, Dan, I want to ask you just a little bit more about the situation specifically in England when it comes to multiculturalism, the problematic issues that exists there within the society, and you know, in the UK to a larger extent, you know, pertaining to ethnicity and some of the issues. You know, you talk about Sheffield a little bit. Another place that I've heard of is obviously Luton, right? It's, I mean, practically all Muslim now, as far as I'm concerned. But I mean, we've heard rumors in the news here and there that we have, you know, Sharia law going, you know, proposed to go into certain British law, etc. How bad is the scenario here in England? We haven't talked about that too much. Maybe you can describe this to us and some of the issues that have arisen because of the wonderful diversity that you've been enriched with over in England.
I would strictly avoid, you know, the sarcastic negativity there, Henrik. It's not, you know, it's not just a, I wouldn't use the term enrichment at all. I wouldn't even humorously state it. I mean, it's not even funny. It's beyond funny. It's beyond sarcasm. It's beyond any sense of, but it's absolutely degenerate what has happened, especially pertaining to our inner city areas. In relation to the countryside, the rural areas, there's almost no immigrant population. So there is massive hope for the retaking of our nation throughout the majority of the country. It's just the cities. Like in every other European nation, it's always the cities which are taken over first because they are the places where the jobs are. They're the economic magnets for immigrants, and immigrant ghettos are built up all around almost every single major city in the UK. Manchester, Birmingham, London, Leicester. They are, well, all of the ones I've just stated have majority non-white children in as the populations. And obviously London is, and Leicester have been confirmed as majority non-white in totality. But in relation to Islam, for example, Islam has not actually gained control over the legal system at all. There has been talk here and there of certain legislative changes. There are informal / illegal Sharia courts operating throughout the UK on a cultural level within Muslim communities. But I don't focus too much on Islam because that's just a symptom of wider mass non-white immigration. Of course, they'll bring in their Semitic religions with them. The situation as a whole in relation to multiculturalism, well, as I stated in hour one, the hostility to immigration is at a record high. So there is absolutely a massive degree of hostility from our people in relation to these non-white immigrants. It's obviously in the ranges of 89% to 94% in this year. So it is both simultaneously horrific, the situation, but yet there is a great degree of hope to be had. Which is not a situation where it's all, you know, hopelessness and it's lost and, you know, the country's in absolute chaos and mm-hmm. we can't retake a nation. That's not true.
Right.
In fact, it's the opposite. It's almost as if, and it is as if, that the Jewish supremacists, they've pushed too hard and too fast with mass immigration and our folk have woken up. And there is absolutely no way this situation can continue. Our people cannot simultaneously be 89 to 94% against immigration and this immigrant population continue to exist within our country. There is massive political change underway in the UK, in England specifically and primarily, and also in Wales. Scotland, obviously, there is potential that Scotland could go independent, and then, of course, there's a whole different question in relation to the proportion of immigrants it has then and whether they leave Scotland, for example. You know, they could all leave Scotland, which could, you know, be a liberation of Scotland implicitly in, you know, as early as 2016. But in England specifically, UKIP obviously achieved, you know, an electoral victory not seen in this country for over 100 years, and that is indicative of our folk themselves, of their consciousness, of their own rights and their own subsequent hostility towards immigration and immigrants taking up our resources, taking up not just resources, because, you know, you can produce more resources, but destroying the fundamental nature of our nation and our people themselves. All these, you know, nationalist groups and so on, they are moderate in comparison to our people, because our people's untapped, both simultaneous rage and righteous anger at the political class and those that control the political class, and our people's rekindling sense of identity and love. For example, the rise in Englishness has now almost exceeded the number of people who identify with being quote-unquote British, which is a term I do not recognize.
Right.
And so there is a massive degree of ethnic reassertion of our identity in the face of a dire situation. That's the summary.
Very good. Future then, the future of the nation, and again, not the geographic location and all that, we talked about that, but the future of, well, I mean, to a certain extent, the lands as well. I mean, I want to get your take on this as well. What if and anything can be, not if, but what should be done in this situation? And here is also where I reckon we have a lot of people who maybe potentially would disagree or whatnot, but the future is, it's something where we, of course, not only have to direct and take the reins of future, we can't just let things run off where it wants to go with it. It's about us taking control of it and dictating to it, of controlling the narrative, if you want to use that term, of where things is meant and supposed to go. But the fact is that we're approaching a scenario where we have huge demographic people moving back and forth, you know, into countries. And do you see a future where you have where you send people back to where they come from again? Are you a believer that we should, you know, send people back to the countries that they came from? What if you have 2-3 generations down the line that they've been growing up in England, they consider themselves to be English and all that, you know, discussion? Where are you on that page, Dan?
Well, just to refute that one point there, people who are second or third generation thinking they're English, that doesn't actually happen in a large percentage of cases. There have been studies saying that even second, third, or fourth or fifth generation non-white immigrants, they see themselves primarily as their ethnicity, and then they don't see themselves as English. The term English is literally not used by non-white ethnic minorities. They'll use then the civic term British, so they'll consider themselves Black British or Pakistani British or Asian British or something like that.
Right.
They don't have an identity attachment to our nations. You got to look at the reason why they came here in the first place. That there is the key to them returning to their homelands. There'll be those that will return to their homelands voluntarily. There are those who want to go back to their homelands right now but cannot due to subjective circumstances and political pressures not being where they should be. And then, of course, there are those who will, on an ethnic, tribalist, territorial level, will not want to give up territory on a primalistic level. And they are, of course, violating our rights as an ethnic group. And thus, we should defend ourselves, which will necessarily involve saying to those people, if you wish to try and to violate our people, out of the love for our people's right to exist, we will defend our lands, as we've done for thousands of years prior to this. And even into the early Christian period, before our people were defiled, we had masses of wars with foreign invading armies continually, over and over, and in between rival European populations even.
Yes.
The idea that something fundamentally has changed in our people's consciousness is ludicrous. We are still the same people who will defend our lands. And yes, there will be some people who will necessarily want to try and stay here in order to violate our rights for the sake of their own selfishness of, you know, they've got a nice house or something, so they want to stay here, or they want to stay here for the sake of spreading their religion, or, you know, establishing a caliphate, or whether they want to stay here because, you know, they think that they deserve to be in this country because of the wrongs of what someone did to their homeland or something. In their mind, it is a zero-sum game, and to a large extent, it is. You cannot say an immigrant has a right to stay in a country without simultaneously implicitly saying that a European does not have that same right. When someone
right.
says one immigrant can stay in our country, they are implicitly saying one European has to be deprived of that right, or that, you know, as you said earlier, there's no such thing as right. you are saying, in effect, that European is going to have to put up with it unless they have the political willpower to retake their quote-unquote rights.
Well, exactly, yes. They have to make that happen. That's my point there. A right is not something that's given to you. You have to be in a controlling... I mean, because this has occurred on the same level that this could be restored again. It's just been steamrolled completely right over us. There's been no voting on the issue. There's been no, you know, asking the people, is this what you want or whatnot, you know? But is all of this, in your view, is not all, but to a large extent, a lot of this conflict that we've been seeing in the world that has caused a lot of the mass migration has been due to a foreign policy, not only, but to a large extent of a foreign policy that have been, controlled by groups, let's say in America, for example, that have been driving the war in so many countries in the last, 40, 50 years, really. But we have, AIPAC over there and stuff like that. And as we know with the Iraq war and Afghanistan war and Libya and everything else, you had kind of America pushing this and then rest of the, not all the European countries, but some of them kind of falling in lockstep with this and just kind of complying to this and creating a lot of these issues. But is the foreign policy one of the points where we've also made a huge mistake by letting this be controlled by external forces? In this regard, we do have major Zionist interests in American and British foreign policy. What's your stance on this?
Yes, undeniably, our foreign policy is absolutely dominated by Jewish supremacists or Zionists, and there is absolutely nothing European about the current foreign policy interventions of our nations that has been conducted without the democratic approval of our people, or even the cultural, or even without the approval of the indigenous media. These foreign wars are not anything to do with our people, other than the fact that our people are the ones who are bleeding and dying in this war.
Yeah.
For the sake of oppressing other peoples who are opposed to Zionism, such as, in Iraq, for example. The one reason Iraq was so high on the hit list was because Saddam Hussein was a geopolitical enemy of the State of Israel. And of course, the State of Israel is a Jewish state, de facto, quote-unquote Jewish state, you could call it. And thus, we have had our sons and daughters bleed and die for, obviously, this non-European foreign policy, which of course does obviously create some backlash, as it is called, in relation to terrorism on our soil. And evidently, this is a mistake, not necessarily a mistake that our people committed. We did not commit it. It is an act of Jewish supremacist manipulation at the highest levels of government, down to the lowest levels of a local media company pushing propaganda in relation to such foreign policies. It's something that has been done to our nations, which is part and parcel with the corruption of our political establishment by Jewish supremacists, and not just the corruption, but the infiltration. For example, just counting religious Jews in the UK, Jews are 300% overrepresented in Parliament. And now if you defined a Jew on an ethnic level, the statistics aren't actually available for that, but it would easily be 1,000% overrepresented. So you see, the European representation within our respective parliaments and thus our respective foreign policies is absolutely diminished, and thus it is natural that our foreign policies are not European in spirit or interest even, and thus necessarily other peoples are violated because of this foreign policy, this Jewish foreign policy at its core, on behalf of the Jewish state of Israel primarily, or Jewish political interests in this conflict or that conflict.
We've seen in Libya, we've seen conflicts in Syria, of course. Lebanon has been issues for many, many, many years, long standing, and of course not the Palestinians themselves and this whole situation there. But part of me have been to a certain extent feeling that what if this is about seeking to bring the issues of the Middle East to not only the rest of Europe, really, but the rest of the world as well. To me, it seems that there has been a potential point here. I'm trying to seek conflict between, let's say, Europe and Islam, that we are to do the bidding of the issues that Israel is facing. I mean, we have, for example, a lot of these, you have Geert Wilders in Holland. We have even the Swedish Democrats, for example. They're staunch Israel supporters, a lot of these people as well, and they are never criticizing Israel, but they're always about criticizing Muslims and Islam, for example. And that's a huge disconnect here. I mean, it's sure it's focusing on part of the problem, but not, as you said before, not the root of the problem. So is this something that is a potentiality here, that we, if we see a huge anti kind of Islamic sentiment arise within Europe, that they're in somehow trying to seek you know, European arms being raised against Islam and Muslims in general, that we kick them out of our countries kind of thing, and then start a massive war with Iran potentially, and some of the other, you know, Muslim countries as well? Is this anything that's on the horizon in their plans, do you think?
Well, definitely it's one of their objectives to create a war between, you know, the Middle East and Europe. It's a typical divide and rule scenario. What we have to avoid, and this is one of the things many nationalist groups, as you just stated, fall into the trap of, which is attacking the symptom and not the problem of our current immigration situation. Like I've said in this interview prior to this, immigration is the problem, and that, you know, Islam is just the spirituality that immigrants bring with them. That we should not fall into any trap of being hostile towards Islam just for the sake of it, because it's a different religion. We should be hostile to it because it's expansionist, and because, not because even of Islam. It's okay when it's in their countries. Islam is perfectly fine when it's in Jerusalem, and Islam is perfectly fine when it's in Tel Aviv. And quite frankly, to overcome the problem of the inevitable, you know, degree of minor hostility between us and Islamic nations after we have, quote unquote, you know, deported or forced out reasonably these non-Europeans in order to secure our right to exist, we can say to these Islamic elements, how about we say to you, if we apply enough pressure against Israel to the extent where it is boycotted until the point where the Israeli regime collapses, you know what? We can send these Islamic immigrants to the second most holy place in Islam, which is Jerusalem, of course. And we can say to them, you can leave our countries and you can go to Palestine. That will be a solution to a lot of the radical Islamic elements and how to deport them without causing conflict.
Do you think that this will be a divisive issue amongst Europeans?
I think that European folk as a whole do not worry too much. They don't focus about on Islam. They focus on immigration. It's these nationalist groups that are infiltrated by Jews or even run by Jews that focus on, in an attempt to divert our attention away from immigration as an ethnic issue, and onto a purely religious abstract focus on Islam. For example, there's this international movement that manifests itself in organizations called defense leagues. There's the English Defense League, Norwegian Defense League, and so on and so forth, which are all in effect Jewish defense leagues. As, of course, you might have known about the English Defense League, it's quite prominent.
Yep.
It's run by Zionists to the core, and it doesn't focus on any ethnic issues, not one. It's purely against, quote-unquote, political Islam.
Right, yeah.
We have to avoid this being promoted in the face of our folk. We have to awaken our folk to the ethnic core and not this diversionary, you know, Islamic threat or so on. We have to not waste any time on that.
Well, I've noticed this too, and just because, you know, I, for example, have criticized some of the measures that have occurred within Swedish society from the Islamic interests that exist there, then people, they're so split in their consciousness that they think, not too many times, but here and there a little bit, you know, it's like, oh, okay, you're anti-Islam. Okay, then you have to be pro-Israel. Or, oh, are you anti-Israel? Okay, well, then you have to be pro-Islam. It's like, I don't care about any of that. I'm caring about my own people and my own country and my own interests. That's what this is about. And I don't want to have anything to do with it. This is a conflict which is, you know, theirs, and it's been long-standing, and we shouldn't, you know, even get involved in it. But the fact is, now we have been drawn into it because it's such an intricate part, unfortunately, at this stage of the demographics of the country, of course, as you detailed, how you know, Israeli and Jewish foreign policy have been, you know, infiltrated into our systems and everything else. So it is an intricate part of it, but I do believe that there can be a separation here at some stage, and a kind of going back to this. But how do you see again then bringing this as a focus to people of enlightening them to to these realities and showing that we don't have to, these are not our problems. We should primarily be focused on our own issues and have our own self-interest at heart. And then from that point of view, when we have a stable, you know, scenario for ourselves and realize that we have our own stuff in order, then at that point, it's of course a question of whether you can, you know, help or aid somebody in other parts of the world if there's a natural disaster and all this kind of stuff, right? I mean, this is like, it's always so divisive. It's always like people believe that just because you have a self-interest, then you are a completely egomaniac and you don't even, you know, you resent other people and all that. So it's a big divide here, and it's a big issue of just kind of overcoming some of the hurdles and preconceived ideas that people have about the type of topics that we're talking about, Dan. So what do you make of this?
Yeah, I think the false dichotomy between these, you know, if you're pro one, you have to be anti the other. I think all sane people will rationally be against the state of Israel as a Jewish supremacist state. So that's not an issue. But that doesn't necessarily mean we have to be pro-Islam within our countries. Of course, and going on to the point you've just mentioned, you can respect another people's right to follow which religion they want to in their own homeland, so long that it does not violate you or your interests. That is fine. But it does not mean that we have to support Islam within our countries, and we should not support Islam as an immigrant religion within our own territorial nations, quite frankly. And we should not support anything Semitic in relation to our people, be that Christianity, Judaism, or Islam. They're all foreign creeds and are nothing to do with our Northern European folk populations. Now, in relation to the idea that reasserting our interests violates others' interests, it simply does not. In relation to immigrants in our country, to a degree, there is a zero-sum game. That if you deport one immigrant, you deport them in order to make room for one of your population. But then that can go the other way. You say that you are deporting them for the rights of your people to ensure this, you know, the right to exist as European folk within our own homelands without being made into an ethnic minority. That's just the reality of nature. You cannot get over the fact that nature is not egalitarian. It is not, you know, liberal and all-encompassing and welcoming. There has to be, you know, an agreement between peoples that if you want to exist in a state where you are not going to be in conflict with other people, you have to be within a state of your own in a homogeneous manner. And only in that situation can you avoid conflict. The UN reported that 80% roughly of all wars in modern history and in recorded history were based along ethnic lines, 80% of all wars. And that in itself not only shows you the ludicrosity of multiculturalism, or multiracialism as it should be called, trying to force multiple races and all cultures and religions as a result of the races that carry those religions into a single territory is insanity, but also that states can only function and exist legitimacy, in a degree of legitimacy, and on a legitimate definitional level, if they are homogeneous, and this needs to be articulated. This problem is a problem of articulation, that you need to tell these other peoples, you need to articulate to them the fact that your rights are not being violated if you're living in a homeland of your own, and we are living in a homeland of our own. There is nothing wrong about that. That is nature. That is how it should be. That is the natural state of things. And quite frankly, they should be content with that, easily content with that. It is the dream and ambition, not only of the Palestinians, but of Iraqis, Pakistanis, Iranians, Syrians, Libyans, Jordanians, and the Lebanese to be able to live in their own countries without the presence of a foreign military influence or conflict bearing over their heads each and every day, and the threat of death and violence and war. You need to articulate this through our people here, the core of the, you know, awakened movements as such, and then on from us to the rest of our folk, and then through our media and through our people and with our positive conversations and alliances with other races in fighting against the common interest on a global level, which is Jewish supremacism, quite frankly. Within our respective nations, we can achieve a level of cooperation and agreement between all nations that will probably see the end of war to a reasonable extent.
So do you consider that what we're seeing now with migration is basically just a new version of the same old invasion that we've had many, many thousands of years? Is it of the same nature, but now it's being done with paperwork and laws to a certain extent?
It's not of the same nature in its cause. Obviously, the cause nowadays is directly, you know, Jewish supremacist immigration promotion. You know, it's documented, it's superbly well documented, both on continental Europe, Australia, America, New Zealand, even Greenland, that you can get a situation where you have massive numbers of non-white immigrants suddenly pouring into a country after certain legislative changes is not the same as the nature of, you know, for example, the medieval invasions of Islamic Moors into southern Europe. It's not of the same nature at all on that level. It is to a degree the same nature that it's foreign peoples invading our land. Yes, that's a continual aspect of our lives, it seems. Those occurred over and over century and century and century. But then this is a very positive point, because for us to exist as the people we are today indicates that we must have, and we did, defeat these efforts, as we will defeat this foreign invasion or immigration effort we are faced with now in the 21st century.
What is ironic here is that this would not occur if it wasn't for individuals amongst our own folk who are not only cultural Marxists, but we also have a lot of crony capitalists, of course, who are actually looking at, you know, wage dumping and a number of other issues where they actually perceive that, you know, this is good for the economy, right? Bring in low wage workers and everything else, and this myth that they are doing the jobs that, you know, we don't want to do, etc. I mean, Sweden, unemployment among immigrants there are, it's just monumental, and it's to the point where we can't take care of them either when they come into the country, right? They become perpetual citizens that goes on welfare, etc., and all that stuff. So it's rather among our own ranks, that's my point, that the problem lies and not with the immigrants themselves. There's something that I've said before.
Yes, that's true, obviously, but in only on a certain level is that true. Because at a fundamental level, you know, Jewish supremacists, they are immigrants to our nations. And these, you know, capitalists or so on, or whatever you want to call them, that take advantage of this situation for their own wealth, are only doing it out of two factors. One, because it has been permitted by Jewish supremacist immigration manipulation. And secondly, because of their fundamental moral corruption, these, you know, people who don't care anything for the nation and only care for profit, that is fundamentally as a result of the Christian defilement and destruction of our original folkish morality, where one's actions and deeds would all be measured by their contribution to our folk. Now that that spirituality has been removed from a large percentage of our population, if not 70% of our population, it's only inevitable that as a result of the Semitic immigrant religion of Christianity, that you now have a situation where members of our ethnic folk are in effect contributing to the damage and degradation of our own ethnic folk is because of this fundamental Semitic manipulation and destruction of our morality as a secondary cause of their primary actions, which are their support. For example, the support, I think in the US is about 70 or more churches and church groups and church alliances that support Amnesty. And obviously you get, you know, Christian businessmen who, you know, they'll support immigration, they'll support the Labour Party in the UK, for example. You get all these heads of the various industry unions, they all support the Labour Party, which supports mass immigration, which means cheap, efficient workers for them, and of course the destruction for this nation. But obviously that would not be happening without the fundamental both moral corruption, which was centuries ago for Christianity, and then in recent decades it has been worsened via, you know, 1960s onwards capitalist corruption of their morality, and then of course the actual legal changes to the immigration laws themselves, which done by, for example, in the UK, Barbara Brosh was the Jewish immigrant minister for the Office of Immigration and Asylum from 1999 to 2001, which is the period under which New Labour let in or started the process of letting in the biggest number of immigrants this country's ever seen. You have the individual Jewish supremacists who will themselves be directly involved in the destruction of our nation's demographic integrity, but they will also always have their slaves. They will always have those who will do their work for them. So yes, you get the horrible situation where you have Europeans, even Northern Germanic Europeans. For example, there's numerous cases of this in Germany. We have Germans, so-called Germans, I would say, promoting mass non-white immigration into Germany and overtly articulating that they're doing it to destroy Germany.
Yeah.
And the same in England.
That's right. Oh, my. Well, this is, you know, we have the scenario of Barbara Spector in Sweden talking to the Israeli Broadcasting Company and quite openly and blatantly. And this was obviously a mistake on their part. They didn't intend this to go out to the rest of Europe in the way that it did on YouTube. That's why they've been fighting it so hard on YouTube. I mean, I can't tell you how many versions of this video that has gone up and down in the last, you know, 2, 3, 4 years or whatever, when actually it was uploaded. But that's clear evidence right there. That's it. That's irrefutable.
Yes. And I actually put that in the recent videos, the two that I've just published, one which is an alternate version of the other video, which I include the Barbara Spector quote alongside other quotes by other Jews and by other people talking about the Jewish influence. Yes, it's absolutely undeniable. But just imagine for a second, that was a mistake. And that was leaked to someone who managed to get it, and put it on YouTube. Imagine how many other hundreds of similar comments there are waiting to be exposed. And that is what the duty and responsibility of folk like yourself and myself is, to find these quotes, to find these Jewish supremacists overtly articulating their hatred and their will to attempt to manipulate and destroy our people, and to expose it in an effort to awaken and inspire our people and to tell them, you're not racist to oppose your own destruction.
No, exactly.
You're rational to do that.
Yes, exactly. And that's just, I want to talk about human nature in a little bit here, but just, and then return to Ozatur. But another question I had here is that another reason, of course, people want to come to the West as well is, you know, partially due to the living standards, if not that's primarily actually the issue here, right? And we've spent generations building this up to a certain extent. And so why are not these conditions not created in those countries instead, like it has in China and India to a certain extent? There's a long way to go in some of those areas, of course, but and I'm not trying to advocating a kind of a monoculture and the same everywhere of just empty materialism either, but I guess I'm saying who wouldn't want to have a little bit better living standards, and why not? I think that this is something that can be achieved in every country, in all parts of the world, and you can do this with, you know, respect for the earth and in the environment in consideration as well. But do you think that that's something that's been held back from other countries? Or what's your view on that? I mean, why have not the same levels of living standards been achieved in all parts of the world? That's a tricky question, I know, but what do you make of that? What do you think?
Well, a nation and its infrastructure is built by the sum total of the efforts of the people of that nation, in effect. So to understand why a nation is what it is, you need to look into the character of the people. And there is, of course, substantial evidence to say that European civilizations are unique because of the European people's excessive work ethic and absolute focus towards building an efficient civilization that has literally held us above the rest of the people of this earth, barring those civilizations such as Japan, South Korea, for example, which are, of course, industrious in their own right. There are, of course, IQ differences between the different peoples of the earth. But regardless of that, even when you have slight differences in IQ, for example, you know, for example, the Indian IQ, which is relatively high, but not that high, you know, around about 90s on average, they had a civilization which was efficient and was large. The same with the Chinese. And of course, it is a combination of their own character. If their people are okay, or were okay, for thousands of years living in that type of, you know, civilization, and with the Africans, for example, for thousands and tens of thousands of years living with almost no building infrastructure, then that's what their people should be like on default. The standardization of people's expectations that they should all live in houses is incorrect. There are some people who were for thousands of years content with living in effectively no housing, and they were happy people, and they lived efficiently. They had no external manipulation. They lived pure and true to their nature.
Yes.
And I think people should live pure and true to their nature. And this commercialist expectation that people should all be living at this certain level is as a result of the international media, which shows, you know, European houses, European streets. That's what one of the tactics that the Labour Party did when they sent out their search parties for immigrants. They would literally, you know, give out brochures and so on with, you know, pictures of houses in the UK saying, yours, just immigrate to the UK, and silly things like that. If you stop that, people's expectations and people's ambitions will return to their natural default. And it's not a negative thing for these people. That's just what they are like. If they want to live like that, they can. If the Japanese want to live in super high-tech housing, they can. If the Africans want to live in little huts, they can. We should not attempt to, by any degree, universalize the commercial or basic infrastructure expectations of nations. We should let nations develop on their own, independently, naturally, without any cultural exchange between the European world and the non-European world.
Nature is not egalitarian, that you mentioned before. This is a huge problem and obstacle that we face because there are so many people, in my view, that are not part of their psyche, is not a part of nature anymore. It's like it's been disconnected, dislodged from this. We have the cultural Marxist, of course, but a lot of other ideologies and political ideologies that are so far removed that makes this discussion, to a large extent, almost impossible, because we literally, the viewpoint on reality and what nature is so very much different, right? So is there, because to me, I don't want to make this too long-winded, but to me, it's almost like when I listen to some of these people and the way that they're exposing themselves of being not in veneration of nature, almost a hatred towards it to a certain extent, it's almost like I'm hearing like a death wish in there. They're like they do not want to be part of the natural world as it exists and reality, and they want to try to create an artificial bubble for mankind and humans where we are to live in, separated from it. There's that kind of the zoo ideology. You go and, you know, look at animals in the zoo and venerate, oh wow, amazing, you know, but it's like it's a museum exhibit. You see it from afar, you're not really in touch with it. So I see that as a huge problem anyway, in terms of the mentality and the mindset of a lot of people that we are trying to get to realize some of the points that we're getting across. So on that note, Dan, how do you think that we can reach these people when it comes to the reality of nature?
Well, effectively, you have to tell them, you have to articulate the fact that the current mainstream in politics is not mainstream. Mainstream, if it means anything, should be the default according to nature. Now, if we had a political ideology spectrum that was drawn up in a diagram showing you, you know, the actual natural political left and right spectrum, you would have nature being in the middle as natural, and you would have every current existent ideology several miles to the left of that, off the edge.
Right.
And you would even have some of the most right-wing regimes in history still to the left of where nature is. And that is the reality we need to articulate. That loving our folk and the political manifestations of that love for our people is the only natural political ideology and is thus the only true mainstream. So we need to redefine through our efforts the very understanding of the political ideologies of today, through our efforts, what you're doing here primarily. You are doing a fantastic job with that. Effectively, we need to articulate to our people that loving our folk is mainstream. Okay, so loving our folk on every single level, including and especially on an ethnic and spiritual level, is the only true and only valid position around which our people should correlate in terms of political opinions, which is therefore defined as the quote-unquote mainstream. We need to get to a situation where our people see being, you know, proud of their identity on every level, including, of course, on an ethnic and spiritual level, as a positive thing, and not just a positive thing, as an intrinsically natural and thus the best position to hold. This needs to be the opinion for our folk, for our folk leaders, and the resulting spirit and culture that imbues and informs everything they do. We need our people to be inspired to this goal. We need our people to be awoken to their own identity. And this is done, of course, through Asatru, as mentioned in the past hour. It is, of course, a ethnic spirituality which ties us to nature. And of course, tying us to nature is the one thing that Christianity did the opposite thereof.
Yeah.
We have, of course, the fundamental distinction in their view of the universe between humans and animals was, you know, one of the worst crimes in intellectual history. The fact that, you know, they abstracted humans to a different level. And then, of course, that means that the natural world doesn't apply to us. And that's one of the fundamental reasons why nationalists, you know, ethnic nationalists cannot be Christians. And we need to overcome that fundamental distinction. And by overcoming that fundamental distinction, to reawaken ourselves to the understanding of nature and all that entails relating to survival and relating to preservation of our people out of a sense of love and out of a sense of rational self-preservation.
Now, a big part of this, as I see it, is also, you know, taking care of our body, our health, develop a healthy mind, of course, a healthy psyche. But, you know, things so simple as eating right, you know, eating foods that have, you know, a lot of natural and good fat, for example, in terms of, you know, for fertility, for the brain, you know, getting away from the grain, eating like domesticated farm animals, even to the extent of materials and the plastics that we use and everything we touch, that we sleep on, that we wear on our clothes. I mean, all of this stuff is affecting our body, which is affecting our, you know, hormone levels, which is ultimately affecting our brain at the end of it, and even how we think to a certain extent. And I think that this is a huge piece of the puzzle to get your mind frame back in the right place. And again, this is yet another example, I believe, which where we've been clearly manipulated on in terms of what we, you know, should eat and what kind of mentality that shapes. So what's your view on the health issue of taking care of our body, you know, getting aware and just get basically get a natural thinking process? Like, there was a way that people ate for thousands of years, and that caused an evolutionary, you know, process. We were adapted to those conditions. Today, in the last, I don't know, maybe 100 years, maybe a little more so, we've started to really go off base in terms of those kinds of things. Today, some people only eat, you know, soy and bread, you know, and it's like, that's it. And this will change your mind even. So health, Dan, is that a big part of the puzzle, do you think?
Yes. And to solve that, this is one principle which also underpins all of Asatru, and you'll like this principle, is you must do everything in accordance with nature, your nature. You must, in effect, live your life not only in accordance with natural, you know, things, doing things in accordance with nature, only using natural substances in relation to your internal consumption, and not against medicine, you know, high technology. In fact, we should be, you know, advancing our technology and advancing our medicine and advancing our efficiency in using certain chemicals and industries and fabrics and so on and so forth. But you should do it with an eye towards having a natural benefit in relation to our people, making sure these chemicals, and having a government which makes sure for us, or even having an advisory body run by people, our folk, who have the interests of our folk at heart, to make sure that everything in our society is both good for us on a natural level, that which is natural and naturally good for us is the only thing that should be permissible in relation to consumption. And obviously, this underpins politics, this underpins health, and of course, it underpins your perspective you take on your life. And obviously, you know, the attitudes you have in relation to your chemical balances in your mind. Living everything in accordance with nature, especially in relation to consumption, is vitally important. Of course, consumption also includes political consumption and, of course, political health and so on and so forth. So yes, health in a broadly defined way is superbly important. And it's only through having a healthy, which also by definition includes highly motivated, intelligent and Asatru informed people, will we be able to overcome our current struggle in order to secure our right to exist, Henrik. And thus, health, of course, is vitally important by that definition and through that interpretation.
Yep. Brought up a good point there in terms of the technology as well, because I've noticed as well, when we talk about some of these things, also to people actually believe that you want to like go back and you know, farm with the oxen again, you know, some of this kind of stuff. It's like, no, I'm not a Luddite. We should, you know, we're the carriers of technology, invention, creativity, mm-hmm. improve things, go on, go further beyond us. You know, it's about all of that stuff. So it's a very important point, not a Luddite idea, not running around with the loincloth. You know, this is like, you know, go the step further, even the next step. I'm actually surprised we haven't gone further at this stage. I think that a lot of this is due to the fact that we've been, the setback down that we're facing is due to the fact that we have to focus on these petty issues that should never have existed in the first place. And this has consequently stifled our progress and the very possibility why we're not out exploring other planets right now, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The absolute chaos and destruction and stifling and holding back of our civilizations. We should already be in space by now with ease. We should already have colonized or set up, you know, expansion efforts on the moon, on Mars, and, you know, sent out countless dozens more drones into space.
Yeah.
At this point in our history, in our evolutionary history, seeing we were capable of launching objects into space in 1940s, of course. Now, the fact of the matter is that we should never, ever aspire to just go back to the way our ancestors live in relation to technology. Our ancestors didn't aspire to live like their ancestors lived. This is a fundamental point. They tried to make their lives better. We must try to make our lives better for our descendants. Asatru, although it last existed in the period where our technology was, you know, farming industry at its max, and that's, you know, there was no industry in effect, you know, minus, of course, blacksmith industry.
Metallurgy,
you know,
yeah.
Yeah, and so on and so forth. And crude, you know, or rather efficient, but still crude, medical practices and so on. We should be aspiring, as our ancestors were, as you can see from the technological advancements under the ages and periods where our folk were informed by Asatru, from the, you know, the early developments of basic tools to large infrastructure products, you know, such as, you know, establishing of hill forts and so on in England in the pre-Christian eras. I mean, you've got massive, absolutely colossal, some of the biggest ancient constructs, you know, in their time period, were in Northern Europe,
yeah,
in England specifically, you know, in Scotland specifically, up in the north, you have massive, great big ancient pagan temples constructed. And they weren't trying to go back to the way their ancestors lived. They were trying to go forward. And that is what Asatru implores us to do, not just to worship the old ways, but to take the quote-unquote old ways, to make them the current ways, and to advance them and advance with our people, with them, to the future, with an augmentation of not only our spirits, our attitudes, our political opinions, but our technology, our civilization's infrastructure. I've wrote numerous articles on the website where, you know, I've articulated even a design for a farming mechanism that would replace all hand-picking crop people, thus to negate the need for immigrant workers to pick on farms, which is an argument that some people use, that, you know, immigrants do the jobs we don't need to do. If you invent the relevant technology, you don't need immigrants to do the jobs that we don't want to do. So we need to be pushing forwards in relation to everything.
Before we go back a little bit more and talk about Asatru and kind of begin to round things up on that note a little bit, let me just ask you briefly about the issues, some of the issues you faced at the university in Sheffield there, in terms of, I guess, with some of the articles you've written or whatnot. You were kind of targeted a little bit because some of your views. Tell us about that.
Oh, yes. At University of Sheffield, which I'm a politics and philosophy student at. University of Sheffield's a very decent university. According to the rankings, it's the best for political research in the entirety of the UK. And it seems some of them did some political research and they found my website, or someone outside the university, it's not known who originally reported me to the university, someone outside the university, possibly in combination with someone inside the university who knew me, reported to the university disciplines committee and, you know, student resources that I had this website. And then from the point where they discovered I had this website, there was a surveillance operation. I had literally, yeah, my LinkedIn profile started getting hit after hit after hit. People, names like John Goldstein, and obvious people with Jewish ethnicities based in Sheffield on their LinkedIn profiles, viewing my profile, trying to, you know, conclusively identify me for a malicious, you know, intent of proving to the university that I'm a student there in order for them to attempt to expel me. Now, I even had, you know, people from researchers from mainstream news websites and media outlets, even one from the Mirror Online, came and looked over my LinkedIn profile to conclusively help to identify that it was me. They didn't write articles on me. They didn't write anything like that. They didn't promote me, because to write articles about someone like myself is literally to promote you, to, yep, give you, yep, airtime in effect. So they maliciously, quietly filed a report, I'm guessing. I never saw it. something happened in relation to the university. Someone in the university got a talking to in relation to me being a student there. Then what followed was, effectively, it was one email message calling me to a meeting saying that, you know, they wanted to discuss my views, and an article I'd written where I had effectively alleged that there was anti-white racism at the University of Sheffield, which I do allege that there is. And there is almost undeniably an atmosphere within the student body of anti-white racism that is festering there. Hmm. Not by, you know, obviously I can allege that because that's within a student body and it's almost undeniable. And I stayed safely within the laws with the article, but they took a massive offense to the fact that I'd written it. And obviously the fact that my website was run by a student, which was obviously me, at the University of Sheffield. They wanted to send a message that, you know, you can't be a student and simultaneously do such a thing. And I turned it around completely. And I can't tell you the contents of the meeting because it was a, you know, confidential meeting, but in effect,
right,
it was a disciplinary hearing, which is, you know, meant to be private and confidential, and I'm not allowed to talk about that.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
effectively what happened inside the meeting was they called me in and they started to interrogate me about whether this was my website. Obviously, yes, self-evident. You've already found that it was my website. And then they started, you know, to attack me on my views, almost beyond, almost outside of the bounds that university staff should be going to. They were literally attacking my views, interrogating my views, trying to deconstruct my views when they should only be trying to find out whether it was me, whether I'd broken any university laws. I had broken no university law or regulation. I'd been talking with, you know, very well-respected members of staff for weeks before this, and I'd got like the support of numerous members of the staff of the philosophy department. I had strong support from all of my staff who gave fantastic report in relation to my character as a student, and they couldn't pin anything on me. And so when in the meeting, it simply descended into the fact that they thought that those views were quote-unquote racist, and that was against the atmosphere of the university, or, you know, the expectations of the inclusivity of the university, and so on and so forth. And thus, after this report that was spitefully submitted against me with the intent of trying to get me expelled, I turned the whole thing around in the meeting and obviously articulated to them, to their faces, what I thought about the atmosphere of anti-white racism. I proved how it cannot be disproved, thus destroying any of their points that I was, you know, committing libel or something. It was obviously, they knew that they couldn't disprove what I was stating. And of course, I turned the whole thing round in relation to the issue of racism. And I said, if anything's racist, affirmative action, implicit or covert, is the ultimate racism.
Mm-hmm.
To discriminate against our folk in entrance into one of the, to a Russell Group university in their own homeland, just for the color of our European quote-unquote white skin, that is the ultimate racism. And the meeting went on and on, you know, technical stuff, covered a load of other things. And then at the end of the meeting, they said they dropped everything. After the first hearing, they were just blown away. And the interrogator, well, I can't tell you what his you know, facial expressions were, but he wasn't happy. And he wasn't looking very confident at the end of it. And everything succeeded.
Yeah. Well, that's good. Good for you. I mean, it's amazing though when you realize that they have this atmosphere of being tolerant of everyone except you. And in this case, you're wouldn't call it a religion, but in their context, you could put it in that bracket and say, listen, this is my religion, and you better respect that. You know, it's like, but nope, not in this case. But that's great that you managed to turn that around and stuff. Yeah. So, is there any additional? Do you think they've do you have a asterisk after your name now with some, you know, footnotes to it? Or what do you think is going on there?
Almost undeniably.
Yeah.
But what this shows, and I think this needs to be articulated clearly, and when I was talking with, you know, Dr. Kevin McDonald, when I emailed him briefly about this, he said, and I'm going to do this at length, and part of this interview is doing this, is to publicize the fact that this is a fundamental and colossal victory. What this shows, Henrik, is you can be someone who is standing up out of love for one's people at a Russell Group university and not be expelled, even if you run, like I do, an entire website that posts extremely open and truthful content, as I will say accurately, rather than the terms they described it,
yeah,
without being expelled. That is a fundamental victory. Now, students in this country who share similar views to myself, and there are thousands of them, who lack the courage to stand up, I would say to them, if even I am not expelled from a university of such a high reputation as Sheffield, you're pretty much safe to talk about these issues. You cannot be expelled as long as you talk about them in a positive and polite manner, articulately and effectively. You can speak openly in defense of our folk, and there is no reason anymore as a university student to be afraid to speak up about these issues.
Yeah. Well, that's good, because that's ultimately what we need. We need more people just talking about this, and at the same time then don't, caring about the repercussions or running around in fear of what some people are going to call you. As you said before, you're kind of open with that a little bit. There's no point in being defensive about any of this. This is just what happened. These are people's interests. This is legitimate stuff. That's what's happening. That's just it. And there's no reason to kind of try to, cower away from that. I think actually will be worse when you do it in such a way. I think it's just, it is an offensive in that regard, going on the offense, a kind of tactic that is necessary, to basically just kind of pierce through all of this BS that we have in place right now. And I think that if more people begin to do that and don't care about those consequences or labels or anything like that, it's gonna actually be tremendous beneficial at the end of it. So I hate to see people in that regard being, sacrificed, for lack of a better term, and ostracized and outed and potentially, banned from if it's schools or jobs or other career opportunities or what have you. But to a certain extent, if that's what we have to do, then that's what we have to do, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have a saying, I am nothing, but my people are everything. And so that justifies to yourself that in the long run, and it's undeniable, as a singular individual, a dot in the great timeline of all your ancestors and descendants, you are comparatively nothing, but your people as a whole are everything. They are your past and they are your future. Sacrificing your career prospects in the controlled system of regular careers is a small price to pay, and it's arguably not even a price to pay, it's a liberation, is nothing in comparison to the great deed you are doing on behalf of your people by standing up for their existences.
Yep, you're right. Now, so do you have plans to go into politics after this, Dan? Is that the direction you want to go?
Yeah, well, Max Weber wrote that politics has two main career paths. There's the politicians and then there's journalists. Journalists are as political as politicians. So in going through media and going through my own website and starting up my own AstroTrue promotion organization, I will be attempting to wage political war against the Jewish supremacists who are attempting to defile and destroy my folk. Obviously, I'm not going to be going into any of the current political parties in existence because they are not accepting of such truthful and honest folkish politics. But obviously, I think the future in retaking our nation relies upon and is going to be written by independent candidates, not associated with any political party, standing amongst their own local people who know them in each respective nation's, local areas, local, each electoral district. And for that individualistic group of folkish, nationalistic, AstroTrue-informed people to form the bedrock of a large resurgence that will not take over the entirety of parliaments, but will be enough to tip the balance of parliaments in our favour, which will then act as a catalyst for further political revolutions. And then on from that, we will eventually retake our nation. And I expect that I will live my entire life fighting for, and will probably end up dying for my people. And that's my life. You call it politics, I call it war.
Well, politics is war. That's the bottom line. Yeah, it is. Well, we could have gone on for much, much more here as usual. We just kind of spoke briefly about AstroTrue, and there is an endless amount of material that can be discussed here, Dan. But I mentioned the website. If there's anything else additionally that you'd like to give out or some recommendations or generally to raise the spirits of the people who are on this page, and I think your message of being, you know, positive is very important and not being defeatist, although the this focus is essential when it comes to awakening people to the reality of it. That's just how things, you know, kind of work and function. But then at the same time, not having the despair too much, you know, prominent in there, but actually having a mentality which is more of this is what's happening. This is what we're doing. This is the direction that we're going in. We just have to be firm and confident in that regard, that this is going to change. That, I think, is one of the most important points here.
Mm-hmm. If you read our lore all throughout Asatru, that which forms the foundations of Asatru as a coherent spirituality, all of our ancestors at some point faced a great battle or a great problem. And Asatru, you know, through its sagas, through the poetic Edda and the prose Edda, and through all the examples of the gods, they all have their great individual triumphs and battles where it seems so hopeless and so dark, but yet they triumph. And even upon Ragnarok, where most of the gods are killed, are slain in battle, they still emerge victorious. And in this era, we have to realize that it is victory or death for our folk, as the majority folk within our nations. Thus, it is suiting and necessary that in this battle we call life, that this realization that we face death if we do not achieve victory for our beloved folk is essential, Henrik, for our motivation to stand up for the rights and dreams of our folk. Each and every member of our sacred Nordic and Germanic folk listening to this interview right now, in order to achieve a level of augmented effectiveness in your efforts to awaken our folk, needs to understand Asatru. Asatru is a pure and beautifully natural, elegant and extraordinary spirituality that will motivate and inspire our folk to fight for the rights and dreams of our people. Asatru is effectively an elemental part of our folk that has been absent and suppressed for so too long. And with the return of our folk spirit, with the return of Asatru, Henrik, our folk shall become purer in soul and unleashed into political action. And that is how we are going to retake our nations.
Very good, very good. We'll definitely begin to end on that note. Very encouraging. Now, can people catch the new videos on your website? Do you have a YouTube channel as well where you upload new videos that you make?
Yes, it's all linked to the front page of the website. So you just need to go to the URL and it's all there, visible.
Definitely, we'll have that up as well for people. Well, thank you so much, Dan. Really appreciate this. We'll need to stay in contact, and we'll definitely need to have you back again in the future and talk more about all these things, because we just briefly talked about some things, but I think this will serve as a really good kind of introduction to some of the things and some of the good stuff you're doing over in the UK. So keep up the good work, Dan, and thank you again for coming on. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, tack.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, or maybe we should say warriors and shield maidens, thank you for listening, folks. I hope you have some new material to consider, look further into, and that your opinions have been challenged. We'll be back with Jay Widener on Friday. Then this Wednesday, we have a new Radio 314 with Michael Griffith on a Southern view of the Civil War. A bit later, we have Gordon Duff from Veterans Today and Sonia Barrett. We'll also speak with David Icke again. And a bit later next month, we have Gordon Kenny and also Gary Biltcliffe. Thank you for listening, and thank you for being a member. I also want to say thanks to the Red Ice crew. We'll be back here with more than in just a few days. Take care, stay healthy, don't forget to sharpen your mind and continue to question. We'll speak more soon.